Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. This is Trumpet Radio Live coming up on this Thursday edition. The economy in the U.S. is growing according to some numbers. We have a list of ways to help you improve your savings. Sweden has seen a lot of refugees in recent years. It turns out that some of those claiming to be children are actually adults. And a new report about washing your hands. You thought you knew everything there was to know about washing your hands. New research. That and a lot more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. And we have a live link at thetrumpet.com. You can also follow us on Twitter if you'd like to, at kpcgfm. And if you have an email, please send those into comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau here today. The two of us, the two-headed monster.
Yes.
And we were talking just before we came on the air, a little hockey. And Pittsburgh won. They're up 2-0 over Nashville in the Stanley Cup Finals. I feel like I'm like I know something about hockey because of what you've brought to my life.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I can enlighten you a little bit. But yeah, it's game two played out last night, and next game Saturday night. But Pittsburgh won both games at home, so now the series is going to Nashville for 2 games, and Nashville has to win. At least one of those 2 games, but they need to win 4 of the next 5 if they're going to win the Stanley Cup. So pretty tough task.
Yeah, very difficult. Golden State Warriors lost last year. They were up 3-1. Cleveland came back, so there is precedent. How about in hockey? Is there a precedent for somebody coming back from like a 3-0 or 3-1, or is it pretty much if you lose 3, you're not going to win?
I think I'm not sure if it's ever happened in the Stanley Cup, but in playoff series, teams have come back from being down 3-0. The last time I can remember is, I think it was 2005 when it was Carolina and Edmonton. Carolina was up 3-0. Edmonton came back into fought back to game 7, and Carolina won a cup in game 7. So I think that's the last time something like that happened. Yeah. At least off that what I remember.
You're an encyclopedia of hockey though, so I take your word for it.
Yeah. Well, if I keep playing hockey, I probably won't have that much of memory left.
Are there a lot of concussions in hockey?
Yeah.
Like football? Yeah, I would think so. You're getting body checked into the boards pretty often, so I can imagine there would be some problems there. You have a Twitter poll that you're conducting. This is related to a topic we talked about yesterday. On which news network do you trust the most right now? And that poll is at Abraham Blondeau.
Yeah, there's I put the big four networks, well, at least the ones that are most popular right now, I guess, but MSNBC, CNN, Fox, and I put ABC News because no one talks about ABC News. So
they were really doing okay. They have David Muir. He's their fairly new guy. He had been doing well, but NBC just won the ratings for nightly news. Lester Holt, I believe.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, they had their fallout after the last guy. Can't think of his name, the guy that lied about everything.
Yeah, he was lied being shot at in Iraq on a helicopter. Brian something, I forget his name, I think.
But yeah, we've forgotten his name. He's washed out that quickly. But he was doing well before then. And then I just read that CBS is firing their guy.
Okay.
He was away on assignment, and they fired him when he was away on assignment. I think he was reassigned, but pretty much was fired. Scott Pelley. And so I haven't seen him too much. I didn't care for him. He always had a comment about things. And usually when you're doing news, they tell you to just report the story as much as possible. Now, I know that's changed a lot recently, but it seemed like whenever they came back from a story, he'd have some personal comment to throw in there. And I don't know. maybe that rubbed viewers the wrong way. The ratings aren't good. So for whatever reason, he's been reassigned.
Yeah. I mean, it is difficult in the news business because some of it is personality. People like watching that guy talk about the news, or there is something about personality. I mean, the most famous American news personality is probably Edward Murrow. And he was very opinionated, but he was on a show that was opinion news. At least when he said those things, it wasn't just reporting the news. And it was during wartime and that sort of thing, so it was a little different. But a lot of these other ones, like Walter Cronkite and others, they were pretty opinionated, but they, I think, were a little more tact in when they chose to say things. Nowadays, it's much different, and pretty much all the news stories today are opinion pieces, whether they're supposed to be or not. And so with the Twitter poll, it's interesting because early results, as in not too many people have voted on it yet, but Fox and CNN are in a neck-and-neck tie right now.
For most trusted.
Yes.
Really, CNN?
Yeah.
That's very interesting. So that's a poll you can check out at Abraham Blondeau and vote on it. Be interesting to see the numbers. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Which media outlet out of those big four do you trust the most right now? Here's a story that does occur from time to time. It's a good warning probably for all of us. Hiker plunges to his death while taking selfie at a waterfall. Every once in a while you hear about something like this. A 25-year-old hiker fell to his death while posing for a selfie at a cliff in Washington's Palooza Falls State Park. Don't know if I said that correctly. On Tuesday, according to local media, his name was Cade Prophet, was taking the selfie with his girlfriend near the top of the waterfall when he slipped and fell into the river, according to the Tri-City Herald. So a nice hike, spending some time with your girlfriend, and then tragedy strikes. And so this has happened from time to time. It's a popular thing now to take the selfie of your, you know, picture of yourself and somebody else, I guess, with you. But people like to go to these really nice areas, scenic areas. But sometimes it's a dangerous spot to be in, and it's hard to focus on taking a picture and watching your balance. So you have to be careful when you're doing that. Hiker plunges to his death there in Washington State.
Yeah. I think some of these pictures I see people take, they do look really dangerous. And so
I think that's part of the rush, right? Or part of the excitement is to get that type of picture.
Yeah, well, I think it makes it more popular on social media the more outrageous it is. And so I mean, I think these people, they're just trying to have a picture to remember their moment with, but so they have to be really careful, and being close to an edge of anything is dangerous, whether you're taking a picture or not. So it's always good to not abandon good safety protocols and just be overly careful, if anything else, because you just never know what can happen with the footing or with the ground on the edge there. But also, just take selfies responsibly, I guess.
I do wonder if they'll have to start sort of chaining or roping off some of those areas, or putting up a sign, maybe they already do, that says no selfies or something like that. You hate to start legislating that sort of thing, but people have to be responsible, I guess. Report from the LA Times. This is a trend that I think everyone knows is happening. Up to 25% of U.S. shopping malls may close in the next 5 years, the report says. Individual retailers within those malls are closing, but then obviously if you can't rent out your space, what do you do with it? Even locally here in some of the malls, where there used to be stores, there are no longer stores now. In one case, it's a game room or something. Another one is a room where you can go sign up to take surveys. Different things that are not really related to, say, the mall experience as far as shopping goes. So I've seen that locally, and that's happening in a lot of places. They say between 20 and 25% of the nation's shopping malls will close in the next 5 years. According to a new report from Credit Suisse, I don't know what that is, but they predict e-commerce will continue to pull shoppers away from the brick-and-mortar retailers. For many, the Wall Street firm's findings may come as no surprise. Long-standing retailers are dying off as shoppers' habits shift online. They expect apparel sales to represent 35% of all e-commerce by 2030, up from 17% today. So a lot of it has to do with people going online from the comfort of their home or the cafe or wherever they are and making their purchases there.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I know from my personal experience and how my wife shops for her clothes now, a lot of the more expensive things are online. I don't buy socks online or anything like that, but the stores where usually we go and browse for a long time looking for nicer clothes, it's not really done that way anymore. And there are a few stores I think that will remain non-online, that won't be touched by e-commerce, and that's places like Lowe's or Home Depot where you have to go there and get supplies, gardening places, those sorts of things are a little more practical. Bookstores are still pretty popular despite tons of bookstores online. People still like going to the bookstore. So, I mean, there's some places that I think will be okay, but these, in terms of being a part of a bigger complex of malls, there's just, I don't know, there's just really no need anymore in our society as it's moving away from that.
Yeah, the thing that is difficult for stores is in relation to, say, competing against the internet. You can find the best price on the internet very quickly, and can compare multiple sources of buying something. And as you mentioned, they have a greater variety of goods. Like, you know, you go to one store, they'll have 10 brands of whatever the product is. You can go online and find 100 different options. And so, and it just comes to your house. And you just click a button. So I don't know how they can survive. And going to the mall is not the experience it used to be. It used to be a little bit more of a special thing, I think, or enjoyable in some ways. And it hasn't felt the same recently as these stores close and the people there get looking a little rougher at times, depending on when you go and where you go. Sometimes it's safer and better just to stay at home.
Yeah. Well, I remember as a kid, going to the mall was a special event. We'd get into the car and or take the public transit and get there, and we'd spend a long time there and just look for things we normally don't shop for every day. And then even as a teenager, with my friends, going to the mall was about going to the food court, eating in the food court, hang out with people there, trying to meet new people in the mall who are just passing through. And that was kind of the part of the experience. And now with social media, you don't meet people like that anymore. You don't need to. You can just sit on your phone and scroll through pictures of people or whatever you want to do. Instead of going to the food court, eating a really unhealthy food and yelling at people.
Yelling at people. Wow. Okay. Well, yeah. Related to that story, Payless Shoes says it's going to close another 408 stores. So they're kind of following suit with some of these other places. We used to have one in one of the local malls. I think that's the place that's now this virtual reality deal, if I remember correctly. It is sort of an interesting game. What used to be there?
Yeah.
As, you know, I try to think back, what used to be in that spot? But they've gone out of business locally in some areas, and they say there's another 408 that are going to close. You bring up an interesting point about the food courts and so forth. One of the things that maybe kept shopping malls going was movie theaters, which are usually related to the food court area in a mall. And but now that's changing too, because people are going to Netflix or online and don't need to actually go watch the movies sometimes. And so there's an interesting write-up here. It's in the latest edition of Fortune magazine, and they talk about Hollywood. They're struggling, I think, over this last weekend, which is kind of the beginning, I guess, of the summer movies. It didn't do great, from what I understand. There was a few movies out by the bigger stars that they expected to do well, and they didn't do that well. And so Hollywood's looking elsewhere to try to make money, and they're looking to China. China is where they're hoping to be saved somewhat, and they're selling more movies over there. And so they talk about what makes a blockbuster in China. The movie companies are looking at this and saying, what does that audience want? They want action-packed movies, big stunts, they say, simple plots, and beautiful actors. Well, that's what everybody wants, isn't it? And they don't want it to be subversive. China has no rating system. They just cut stuff out. So they're not going to give you a PG-13 or an R. They're just going to eliminate it from the movie. So they want action, but they don't want it to be too explicit.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I know with the Transformers movies, the director, Michael Bay, got a lot of flack because in a couple of his movies, he involves China. And it extends the movie for about 45 minutes. There's really no reason for it besides trying to market Transformers for a Chinese audience, like trying to get them more involved. And it portrays China in a very positive light, all that sort of thing. And that description explains a Michael Bay movie very well.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting that people in America are like, well, that movie was terrible. Why did you do that? But it's because they're playing to a bigger audience and it might pay off in the long run.
Yeah. They're looking to make money where they can. Here are some of the numbers for the movie industry in China. There's been 144% growth in China's box office revenue since 2012. North American growth was just 6% in the same period. It's a pretty drastic difference there. The number of movies, movie screens in China at the end of last year, 40,917. That's more than double what it was in 2013 and surpassing the 40,759 in the U.S. It's a new market over there, and people are, I guess, being exposed to this entertainment from the U.S., and so obviously they're hungry to get it. 82%, that's the share of box office sales for the Fate of the Furious, part of that Fast and Furious group of movies, I guess, that came from outside the U.S. So you can look at it here in the U.S. and say, boy, that movie bombed. Well, check out China. They made 82% of their box office money in China, and so they probably don't care too much about where it's coming from as long as they're getting paid. And so you know how it is. Sometimes somebody might not be quite as popular in the U.S., but they can be very popular in China or some other nation, and at the end of the day, they're still getting paid quite a bit.
Yeah, and it reminds me of something really interesting just with some of my people, my generation, friends, and people I know. A lot of them like watching Asian dramas, Korean dramas, movies made from these Asian countries, which are put in a historical sense or have just Asian culture in them. They're not Western at all. And they like watching those more than Western movies. So it's kind of, in a sense, they're kind of having this flip-flopping where like anime and a lot of Asian-type animation and movies are very popular in the U.S. right now. And then in China, these other places, American media is becoming more popular. So it's just kind of a interesting flip-flop.
Yeah, I guess people are intrigued by something different. There is, I guess, some good news as far as the U.S. economy is concerned, depending on the numbers you look at. According to Fox Business, they say job gains in the private sector far outpaced expectations in May, payroll processor ADP said Thursday, adding to sentiment that the U.S. economy is seeing a rebound in the second quarter from a sluggish first 3 months of the year. The private sector added 253,000 jobs last month, far outpacing Wall Street expectations for a gain of 185,000 jobs. So 205,000 net new jobs, they say. So, some good news there. I think they said, I forget what the exact quote was. It was, booming. They didn't say booming, but they said something similar to that. Sort of an interesting phrase. I wish I remembered what it was for a very specific business report from a Wall Street firm. Rip roaring or say, it was some yes. sort of a phrase that you don't hear a lot or an expression. So anyway, the economy is adding some jobs. So on some level, it looks like there is some growth.
Yeah. I think the stock market's up right now. And I did see an interesting thing from Zero Hedge this morning, just where in May, U.S. Spending on infrastructure construction was down 1.4%. And I don't necessarily know why that happened, but they're saying like, well, there's lots of jobs, but construction actually shrunk on infrastructure over the month. So, which is surprising because there's construction everywhere. but yeah, there's, it'll be interesting to see how long those jobs last, if they're just summer jobs, because now this June, lots of people out of school, high schoolers are going to be getting jobs. So there'll probably be some growth that way, but I'm not sure if they're long term.
Yeah, they don't often tell you what the jobs are. So it's kind of a surface look at the data. But it is some positive data, at least for now, in relation to startups and new companies that try to get going. There are a few that are trying to go forward with the flying car, everyone's dream. Self-driving cars. What about the flying cars? They say all your flying car questions answered here. This is a quick little write-up. They say, do these really exist? Yes, they do. More than a dozen startups are working on airborne passenger vehicles that can be loosely defined as flying cars. China's plans to introduce passenger drone flights in Dubai this summer. So I don't know if that would be more of like a tourist, like a amusement ride, or if it would be an actual transportation service, but they're planning to do that. There's a startup backed by Larry Page, aims to have a flying vehicle on sale by year end. And they have a little prototype. It looks kind of like almost like a jet ski, sort of, but not really. Like a raft with a jet ski under it. Uber wants to add them to its fleet. Uber, they're trying to do everything, and they're losing a lot of money from what I saw.
Yeah.
And Airbus has a flying car concept. They say, do they work? They're pretty close. The problem, what's the catch, or the problem, or the holdup? Regulations and infrastructure. How do you regulate a flying car? We have a hard time not crashing into each other on the ground. Now everyone's going to be flying. It seems really neat. Like there'd be a like it could be great, but it could also be a disaster. So I think that's probably going to be the hold up there. How do you regulate it? How do you control it? Where do you go in these vehicles? Are you going to crash into drones? There's a lot to think about there.
Yeah, that was my first thought. Is we have a problem with vehicular accidents on the ground. Imagine having young people driving those things everywhere. It's just, I think, a disaster waiting for happen. And they do take a lot of skill as well. It's not like driving a car. And I don't know. I just think it's very impractical because we'd have to change the entire infrastructure of every country to accommodate these things. Can they drive just over roads? But what about the cars on the road? Where are they driving over private property? Are there any rules about that? It's so much can go wrong, and our society isn't set up to accommodate them that I don't know. And I just don't think it's the safest form of transportation. I just would rather stay on the ground most of the time.
I think it's one of those things where it seems like a great idea if you're the only one that has it.
Yeah.
But if everybody's got a flying car, now you've got some problems. And what happens when it stops working? While you're flying, or what about texting and flying? You know, there's a lot of questions. Power lines, trees, birds. Anyway, they're still looking at it. And maybe it would have a practical use within a certain controlled area or something, but who knows? It reminds me of those sci-fi movies or Star Wars where you see a city from the future and there's all these levels of people zipping around, not crashing somehow.
Yeah.
But so, who knows? We'll see if we get there. It would be fun to try, though, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think those things are awesome to experience, but I just think they need to be in a very controlled environment or a lot of things can go wrong. I mean, it happens with cars or people just riding a bike or different taking a selfie. I mean, you just have to be really careful how these things are instituted, and it sounds like they are being really careful, so that's good. But I definitely want to avoid a Back to the Future type reality in which you're flying around and you can't see and you're putting trash in the back of your car to produce energy. That's not ideal.
This is not what we want here. Here's an interesting story from Heat Street. Tests show 76% of suspicious child refugees in Sweden are actually over 18. This is one of the tough things with the refugees coming into, well, really anywhere, but I guess Europe. They don't have a lot of records on them, and they'll tell them they're a certain age, but that may not be the case. And that's kind of the narrative that, well, it's women and children coming, but not always. Age verification tests carried out on migrants who claim to be children have found that 76% of them are actually aged 18 or over. Swedish migration authorities released the findings of a wave of tests carried out on new arrivals to the Scandinavian country who claimed to be underage but raised the suspicions of authorities. So that's the numbers we're looking at, people that they thought were suspicious. 76% of those turned out to not be children. Medical examinations, which included analysis of migrants' teeth and knee joints, which is interesting. I didn't know you could gauge the age off of that, but found that the majority of those claiming to be children actually were not. Sweden's forensic medical agency, I won't try to pronounce their name. Actually, maybe I will. Rots Medicine Alverkt. Yeah, I'm sure that was dead on.
Yeah, you nailed it.
Nailed it. Has so far tested 581 migrants and found evidence that 442 of them were 18 or older. So that's not good. Obviously, it seems pretty obvious that they would be intentionally lying. I suppose there could be a case where they weren't sure how old they were, but and the thing, they don't tell you how old they are, and maybe they don't know. You know, I can't imagine somebody, you know, at 50 trying to claim they're 18, but if you're in your mid-20s, I mean, it could go, you could maybe pass for younger.
Yeah, I think it's, and I'm not surprised that this is going on because it is easier to get into a country if you're assumed to be a child or something like that. But still does confirm earlier reports that most of the migrants entering are young men. They're not women and children, but they're between the ages of 18 and 27 or something like that. They're in that range, and it is a big problem because it's just with papers. A lot of these Middle Eastern countries do not have identification papers and records like we do in the West here. And so if you're trying to identify who someone is, there's no possible way of really doing it. If you have a Syrian refugee coming in, are you going to call the Syrian government and ask them to confirm their identity? You can't.
Right.
So it's a difficult situation. And they're going to find out one way or the other how old you are, I guess.
Yeah, this report, I'm sure, won't put any positive light on the refugees, because I think there is that thought out there that there is a little bit of that funny business going on, and this sort of confirms it. So anyway, interesting situation over there, and that's the test shows 76% of suspicious child refugees in Sweden are actually over 18. So there's an interesting write-up here about Bigfoot. I don't think there is a Bigfoot out there, but who knows? There could be some weird creature that we're not aware of. My guess is there is not. But some people look for it, and you know, they're kind of interested in it. And so there's this write-up in this magazine. And the only thing about it that I found interesting was some of the names that people use for Bigfoot, depending on where they live in the world. Sasquatch, that's a common one.
Yeah.
What did you call it in Canada? Sasquatch, Bigfoot?
I think I've heard both. Yeah. Some people call people from Saskatchewan Sasquatchians.
Oh, there you go.
So I've been called a Sasquatch before.
Yeah, so it's everyone's aware, I think, that there's this thought of some big thing in the woods. And who knows? You know how it is. People have seen things in the woods. Maybe it was a bear. Maybe it was a big guy. I don't know. People have seen things. I remember being a kid and hearing all sorts of things from my peer group. Oh, I saw something, you know, and it probably was a neighbor dog, but they were scared about it. But here are some of the names that are used for Bigfoot or people within that realm. Some people call them the hairy people. Others refer to Bigfoot as the stick man, boss of the woods, living solid face. And I don't really get that one. Big elder brother. That's one of the Indian tribes call him that. Or the frightener. I've never heard those names before. I thought it was interesting. I like the frightener. I like boss of the woods. I don't mind the stick man, even though it makes it seem like he's skinny.
Yeah.
Living solid face. That one confuses me.
Yeah. Have they like been in a boxing match and tried to punch it? I don't know. I don't know how they would know that about it.
I mean, if you saw this huge hairy thing in the woods, would you come back and try to describe it? And people say, "What did you see out there?" And you say, "Living solid face."
Yeah.
And they're like, "Oh, okay."
That's not the most distinguishable characteristic, I don't think. But I'm surprised people don't call it Chewbacca or something
yeah.
like that. Because I'm pretty sure that's what Chewbacca is.
Because you and me, we would both be living solid face.
Yeah.
We're both alive. Our faces are solid, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
That's, they're not liquid.
Yeah, at least most of it isn't.
Most liquid. Of it yeah. isn't. So that I just thought those were interesting because I've heard Sasquatch and Bigfoot. And there's all these different names, these different legends, depending on where in the world you are.
Yeah, and then there's like the Yetis, the Bonneville snowmen,
yeah.
All them too. And yeah, it's growing up, my brother and I like watching these shows on the conspiracy theories about Loch Ness or
yeah.
Bigfoot, the Yetis. And it is really interesting because stuff happens. I mean, these people have scars from attacks and different things, but you don't know what it's caused from. And they could be imagining something or making it up or who knows what it is. But it is interesting just seeing how much money and time is everything is spent on finding Sasquatch or Loch Ness, that sort of thing.
There's some very funny videos yeah. online about local news stories where people claim to have seen a Bigfoot. They're usually not the most credible people.
Yeah.
You don't see too many businessmen talking about it. It's usually somebody's been out in the woods a long, long time. So anyway, some interesting names there. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Key David program coming up, also the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. If you missed any of those, you can get the archives at kpcg.fm or thetrumpet.com. Also, a new episode of The Sun Also Rises today with your host, Jeremiah Jacques, so check that out. Trumpet.com, top story today, Iran and Hamas are back together. Related to that, Iran forcefully developing missile capabilities, and Iran conquered Lebanon. Now what? So those are the top stories at thetrumpet.com. Check those out. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live. I'm Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau here today. And the economy, as we mentioned earlier, they say is doing somewhat better, at least for the time being. Depends on what numbers you look at, I guess. But here's an interesting list. 8 things to give up if you want to retire by 40. That might be a bit of a stretch for some. plus, what would you do with your time? But some good tips for saving money. So we'll look at this. One thing they say to give up is mindless spending. It's easy to just spend money and not really think about where it's going, and it adds up quick. But they say it's a good idea to write down what you're spending and what you're spending it on, and that'll help you eliminate some of that mindless spending.
Yeah, I think a big temptation is spending on impulse, which is, I think, the same thing what they're talking about. That you're someplace, you see something you want, it's not that expensive, or you're hungry and you want to grab some food. Those sorts of things are easy. They don't cost much, but if you do it once a week, that's in a month, you can spend $50, $100 pretty quickly. And not a lot of people can have such a draconian lifestyle where every cent has to be accounted for. You can't spend it on anything else.
Right.
I mean, sometimes you have to do what you have to do, but I think people do like having a little bit of relaxation where they can go and enjoy something once in a while.
It's nice to have a little fun money, as they call yeah. it. Yeah. Well, another thing they say to avoid if you want to improve your savings habits is lifestyle inflation. Don't spend every nickel and dime. And that's the temptation, that the more you make, the more you spend. It seems like it goes that way, where all of a sudden you can't afford something, or you're getting closer to affording it, so you just keep upping. You see that all the time with people that have made a lot of money in entertainment a lot of times, or sports, where all of a sudden they go from not a lot to a lot, and what do you do with it? Well, typically it's a couple of new cars or more, other things like that, and then eventually the money runs out and you have all this stuff that he can't afford. So a lot of times it happens. Matter of fact, when players now get drafted into the NBA, I think, and probably a lot of leagues do this, I know the NBA does, they take them to a rookie sort of seminar, tell them the stories. Look, this guy made a lot of money, he lost it all, don't make these mistakes, stay out of trouble. But a lot of it is talking about controlling your lifestyle, which is hard to do when you're young and all of a sudden you got this money.
Yeah, I think it's good to have a pretty basic standard of living, and it doesn't mean you don't have nice things or you can't enjoy yourself, but if you spend it so lavishly to where you're not saving anything, lots of events can overtake you in your life to where you're not prepared for them. And so that's just a really good point to keep in mind.
Another thing to avoid, buying lunch and dinner every day. It's easy to have that money just disappear. And eating and cooking at home, it's better for you. Again, they're not saying don't ever do it, but if it's every day, it can add up. Excess living space. It's kind of a popular trend now. People are trying to, maybe get out of a house that's too big into something smaller. Sometimes in an extreme way.
Yeah.
You can live in a box, but you're living in a box. So, but in some cases, downsizing is helping people. And they say you should not try to show up your friends by keeping up with the Joneses, as they say. Who are these Joneses, anyway? I knew some Joneses. you don't want to, you know, try to keep up with the standards around you or what you think are the standards. And in some cases, they say people can consider whether or not they need a car. Out here in Oklahoma, you pretty much do. But if you're in a place like, say, where you grew up, where there's a lot of public transit, you may not need a vehicle.
Yeah, you can get around with taking the bus pretty much anywhere, and the C train in Calgary, or in Regina, Saskatchewan, it's really good too. But or even if you do have a car, you don't have to drive it that much. You can save gas and that sort of thing. So yeah, there's lots of good options there. But it just depends on where you live and what you're doing, and it's all circumspective, I guess.
They say you need a willingness to wait and see as far as pretty much a clear goal for saving instead of just throwing it in a pile. It's good to have a goal. And then also don't procrastinate. Get to it, even if it's a little bit, and it's no one starts with $1 million. It takes a while to get there. So those are some tips that are probably pretty helpful as far as saving some money. We have some good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about that as well that you can find about financial planning and so forth. We have a health story, Abraham, about washing your hands, which I thought we knew all there was to know about that. Before we get to that, one other sort of health-related note, they're talking about people struggling to sleep, and in some cases it's because too much caffeine intake. 5 unexpected foods that contain caffeine. This first one is not surprising, but maybe the amount of caffeine is surprising. Orange soda. They say it has Sunkist actually beats Coke when it comes to caffeine content. I don't know that that's surprising. I guess because it's orange, maybe you think it's maybe we would think it's not as bad. 1 12-ounce can of the orange stuff includes 41 milligrams of caffeine. Coke has 34. So I don't think anyone's drinking orange soda and, you know, then trying to doze off, but unless you're 15. But anyway, there's a lot more caffeine in that than people may assume. These other ones may be a little more surprising. If you eat flavored almonds, there's caffeine in that. Sometimes you can get almonds and they have different flavors they put on them. Pain relievers have caffeine in them oftentimes. Protein bars will have caffeine in them a lot of times. And fancy water, energizing water, rejuvenating, those types of things. You have to look. A lot of times there is caffeine in there. Those are some foods that you may eat or drink and think there's not caffeine in there, but there is. So you have to pay attention to that.
Yeah, those are some really good tips because usually after dinner, before bed, people like to snack or have something, a little bit to eat. And if you do have trouble sleeping, those are some good tips to avoid eating those foods that might keep you up and replace them with maybe something that's a little more inducive to sleep or healthier, something like that.
I watched a little bit of an interview with the golfer, John Daly.
Yeah.
You familiar with him?
He's a
very good golfer, but sort of notorious for some bad habits, smoking, drinking, eating. And it was a very interesting interview that he was talking about what he would consume, and it was pretty mind-boggling. Like how much soda he would drink. Diet Coke, he was pretty well addicted to that. The amount of McDonald's he would eat on a regular basis. And he's one of the, and I hope things go well for him. My guess would be it's all going to catch up at some point. And I think it already has. He's had some problems. But he is one of those funny guys that the heavier he was, the better he golfed.
Yeah.
Because when he was in college, his golf coach wanted him to lose weight, and he lost weight. not well. That's actually how he started smoking. The coach told him to start smoking so he wouldn't eat as much. Horrible, horrible advice, of course. But he actually golfs better the heavier he is. I mean, to a point. So anyway, just mind-boggling what some human bodies can stand. But again, it does catch up to you.
Yeah, I remember my favorite memory of John Daly is, I forget which golf tournament he was at, but he, on his opening drive, he did it off of a Diet Coke can.
Yeah.
And he nailed it. It was a really good drive. Then he picked up the Coke can and started drinking from it because it opened it when he did the drive.
That's amazing. You know, the funny thing is that type of behavior makes you a fan favorite.
Yeah.
Like he's like every man. You look at that guy and you think, well, that's just like anybody you'd see, but he just happens to be a phenomenal golfer.
Yeah.
And he's always wearing like sweatpants with the American flag on it and stuff. So he's a really likable guy, really, really the likable guy, but he's got some really bad habits as well. So that was an interesting interview. Washing our hands, that's something that our parents tell us to do. I think I told my kids to do that today. Always have to remember to wash your hands. There's a new report from the BBC. Washing hands in cold water, they say, is as good as doing it in the hot water. That's different than what I thought.
Yeah, I think my entire life, at school, at home, and then even at work, places I worked, you have to wash your hands and they have steps and the temperature of the water and how much soap you use, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they've got the little chart by the sink and the little drawings, and they show you how to do it when you're a kid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They have all these diagrams and like, okay, well, make sure you actually use your hands and not something else. So it's
use soap.
Yeah.
Did you use soap? That's the question. Well, no.
Yeah, but as far as I remember, every single one always talked about using warm water or hot water. And this is a small study, and they're going to do some more testing to see if it's wider. But basically, they took 20 people and they used water that at different temperatures, 15 degrees, 25 degrees to 38 degrees. And what they would do is they put some harmless bugs like bacteria on their hands. And then they had them wash with different amounts of soap in the different temperatures of water to see what correlation there is between temperature, soap, and getting rid of the things on your hands that you don't want there. And they found out that the temperature of the water didn't affect anything. That the 15 degrees washed just as much with soap as did a 38 degree water with soap. And they're hoping this could save a lot of money for restaurants, for employees who wash their hands, that they could use cold water instead of hot water.
And we're talking Celsius here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, this isn't Celsius.
Right.
So 15 degree, zero is freezing. So 15 is pretty cool, but it's not bad. 38 degrees is a third of the way to boiling.
Yeah.
A little past a third of the way. So it's what, if you turn your tap and let the hot water run for a few seconds and put your hands under.
You know, I think I've kind of been doing this for a while anyway, particularly at, say, a public venue, because you never know how hot the water is going to be.
Yeah.
And I've been burnt, not severely, but enough where it hurts a few times to where I'm like, well, I don't want to get blasted by this boiling water. And so I think I usually have actually kind of just done the cold. I don't know that I would have admitted it, but now that the new study is out, I will admit that.
Yeah, you have science backing you up now.
Yeah. I am. Science is on my side.
So this is interesting because it does go against the conventional wisdom and maybe common sense, because we think, well, hot water
burns away the bacteria.
Yeah, like we use it for washing dishes. We use it for sterilizing things. Use boiling water to clean pretty much anything, kill off bacteria. So it is an interesting thing. But I think the key to washing your hands, they have some steps here how to wash your hands according to experts. I'll get to in a second.
The experts.
Yes, and washing experts. But the key is that you actually use water, use soap, and you do it for longer than 2 seconds. I think that's the general key to hand washing success.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. If you, when you become a parent, you always will have hand wipes around somewhere, typically in the car or something. Or if you have a little baby, you know, you need the wipes for their diapers and stuff. And those are just, you know, they're not warm, obviously. They just have the, whatever the sterilization chemical compound is on there. And that's supposed to do a pretty good job. They even do it at gas stations now, which was pretty neat, actually, because when you fill up your car, you, obviously you got the pump on your hands. And then and there's some of them, even one of the ones down the road here, where they'll actually have either those sort of towelette things you can pull out, or you actually like that. It's hand cleaner,
like hand sanitizer.
Yeah, hand sanitizer to where you don't need the water with it. But those things are all obviously cold, or room temperature, and they seem to work fine. Maybe a little different makeup of what chemicals are in them, but so we've all been doing that for a while too.
Yeah, I don't think temperature is really the key. I think there's lots of different ways to do it. And I think using soap or like with hand sanitizer, it's alcohol and different things that kills off the bacteria. And we're not talking about heavy duty bacteria where you need boiling water to kill off like a virus or something.
Sure.
That's a little different. But just everyday things. I do remember for science class, I had to do some research, and it was about I looked into hand washing, and some universities did a study. They would take a sample of the bacteria in their hand, then they would grow it in little petri dishes so they can look at it under a microscope and see what's there.
Yeah.
And they found that over 50% of bacteria on a college student's hand were intestinal bacteria. So in other words, those people weren't washing their hands, or they weren't doing it very well, because the bacteria from their intestines was on their hands.
Yeah.
And they were walking around and doing everything. So
I prefer not to know that, actually.
Yeah. So just
but it's true. Yeah. Yeah. Probably in a lot of cases, because hand washing isn't maybe done as well. Most cases you see people wash their hands. There are times, I think we've all been there, where you're using a public facility and the person walks out and they don't wash their hands. You're like, what are you doing? But you know, some people just don't, I guess, for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's one of those simple things that is sanitary and helps. It's kind of like a social nicety, but that is often neglected. And so here, this is from BBC, according to experts, this is how you wash your hands. And there's about 50 steps.
Really?
I'm just kidding. Oh. There's about 10.
That seems like a lot too.
Yeah. Washing your hands properly should take about as long as singing happy birthday twice. So about 20 seconds, they say.
Okay.
Wet hands and apply enough soap to cover the whole surface of the hand. Step 3, rub palms together with fingers interlaced. Step 4, rub each palm over the back of the other hand with interlaced fingers. I wish they had diagrams for this.
Yeah, I'm getting a little confused. Yeah.
Yeah. Step 5, rub between fingers on each hand. So you're going in between the fingers. Step 6, rub back of the fingers. So rub the back of them now. 7, rub around each thumb. 8, rub both palms with fingertips. And then rinse with warm or cold water. Step 9, dry your hands well, ideally with a disposable towel. And step 10, shut off the water with a disposable towel if you don't want to touch the sink area.
This is sounding like germaphobe territory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's pretty, that's a good way to do it. I guess, particularly if somebody is working in, say, food preparation or something, I would really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think in public places like an airport bathroom or something, or any public restroom, I think we're a lot more careful of what we're touching and how we're washing. So I think these are good steps. In your own house, I think it's a lot more cleanly than a public area.
Yeah. Wow, that's a lot of steps.
Yeah.
I'm glad I don't have to be the person to write down the steps for things, common things that we do. It would be hard. You know, if you had to try to write down step by step how to tie a shoe, I don't know that I would do real well with that. I know how to tie a shoe, but to like step 1, step 2, step 3. Some people really like that and are good at that, but I don't want to think about it. I just want to do it.
Yeah. It's interesting. Some people do have to write up procedures for their whole lives. I mean, especially for kids. I mean, their whole life is legislated on posters around the room for them. But for adults, we kind of do stuff from muscle memory and we're expected to do it. But if you actually did write down the steps of your everyday, I think it'd be amazing. There are thousands of different protocols we go through every day and just part of our routine.
Yeah, amazing. It speaks to the how amazing the mind is.
Yeah.
They can do all those things. That's from BBC.com. Washing hands in cold water, as good as hot. It is a small sample size, so we're not saying change your routine, but interesting to look at. And the time remaining, you have a history note for us today. You want to talk a little bit about the history of America's relationship with Germany? That's quite a long and complex relationship and very much in the news now. and take a look at why it wasn't always destined to become strained. Why it was always destined to become strained. I totally ruined your intro.
That's all right.
Yeah,
so.
It was destined to become strained. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I think in the news, a lot of it's been over President Trump's visit to NATO and the strained relations with Chancellor Merkel, and then the negative press Trump gets in Germany. 98% of it is negative.
Really?
From the German press.
So it's worse than the U.S.
Yeah. So Germany is his biggest critic, and there's a lot on the trumpet.com and Trumpet Daily about this relationship. But I thought if we just look back at it, it is a complex thing to understand, but it is interesting in the light of recent history on why Germany is so antagonistic towards America. And part of this is Victor Davis Hanson wrote a piece for Today in the National Review called The Old German Problem, and he addresses some of this here. But just to start off, I remember my parents telling me a story, because my dad was posted in Germany during the Cold War in the early 80s, late 80s. And she was at a store trying to buy something. She couldn't find it. And so she asked, she was trying to ask this German woman where it was, and she wouldn't talk to her in English because she thought she was American. My mom was American. But when my mom said, no, we're Canadian, we're here, and we're trying to find it, she's like, oh, you're Canadian. I thought you were American. Okay, well, I'll show you. And, I mean, in World War II, the reason why Germans like Canadians is because of our contributions in the World War. And that doesn't vary a whole much from America. In fact, America's done a lot more for Germany since World War II than any other nation. But there's this antagonism, natural antagonism of Germans against Americans. And in light of everything America's done, stopping Hitler, a big part of that, America's contribution towards that, the Marshall Plan, in which America gave about $14 billion to Germany to rebuild after the war. You have the Berlin Airlift, which allowed West Berlin to remain free. You have the Cold War, in which American troops were posted in Germany for 45 years, protecting them from the Soviet Union. So, I mean, there's lots of things that you think Germans would be maybe a little more grateful for in their general outlook on Americans, but it's not the case. And a lot of it has to come from, this isn't true for all of them, but a sense of cultural superiority, which dates back to World War One, and that really hasn't gone away, to where Germans think that American independent spirit, the outspokenness, open emotions of most Americans, and those displayed in politicians are cowboyish, amateurish, and that Americans should act more like Germans. And so there's kind of this, it's a culture clash, and Germans kind of have a condescending nature against Americans.
Yeah, I've read a little bit about that time period and shortly after World War II. Really, some really interesting books. One in particular where this girl described her situation, a German girl, and it was a horrible, horrible situation, especially when they started losing and the Russian troops came through. Very terrible time for her family, just absolutely terrible, as it was for many people in that time. And they went through a lot of very difficult times and were able to escape to West Germany. And then from there, I think, went to the UK. So it was really an interesting history. But at the end, it turned, and I didn't like what she wrote at the end, because she started to bring out this antagonism she had against the West, against Winston Churchill. America would be lumped in there. And there was just this anger towards them in her writing, saying, look, you know, they're no better than Hitler. They killed a lot of people too. So, you know, I'm not saying that's indicative of a lot of people's thinking, but that was her thinking. And I thought, well, what a terrible way to end this book. I mean, but from her standpoint, life was fine. She denied that they had any sort of tie in with Hitler. Well, that was him. That was his ideas. That wasn't us. They experienced some horrible things as a result of the war, and then blamed the West, really, in a lot of ways for it, even though the West provided a chance for a pretty good life after the war. A lot of conflicting emotions there in this one author's piece anyway.
Yeah, I think there is some resentment there because a lot of Germans died, German civilians died at the hands of the Allies during the bombing runs over Germany, especially in Dresden, Berlin, those types of places, just terrible loss of life there. But that is not the Allies' fault. That's Hitler's fault because Hitler was going to conquer the entirety of Europe and maybe the world if he wasn't stopped. And so I understand the personal antagonism that can be grown from that, but you can't lay the blame at any Western leader's feet, except maybe we should have done more to prevent Hitler in the first place. But in any event, that kind of antagonism is there, but also I think it stems from something deeper, and that is historically, Germany is a very old country. America is not. Germany warred with France for power. Germany was a world power for a long time. Then the British came along, and Britain was a world empire. Germany kind of lost out to Britain in colonialism, and Britain and Germany did fight together a lot against France and other countries. But Germany was lost on the continent. Prussia, they didn't really become a huge world empire like Britain did. So I think there's some jealousy from the elites in Germany against the British Empire back in 1914. That's a big reason why Kaiser Wilhelm went to war, because he wanted the empire that Britain had. And so Germany was supposed to be the next empire, not America. But after World War One, Germany loses, America rises to be a superpower, and now all of a sudden Germany's place in the sun is blotted out by America. And Germany tries again with Hitler in World War Two. It doesn't work, and America is there. So I think some of it is, like you mentioned, those personal experiences. Some of it is cultural condemnation of German ideals, thinking they're better than American ones, as Victor Davis Hanson points out. But I think some of it too is envy. The elites in Germany, from their historical perspective, that they were supposed to be the next great empire, not Britain or America. But that's not how history played out.
Right. And then that thinking probably does filter down to people's personal views, whether they know why or not exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely a strained relationship today. So pretty interesting topic, and there's a lot about that at thetrumpet.com. That's all the time we have for today on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and The Sun Also Rises coming up. For myself, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondo, have a great rest of your Thursday. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.